information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care. It shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
As the years passed, most Americans were able to return to life much as it had been before 9/11, but I never did. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 107 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's the beginning of the end of the Bush era. We've got Patrick McGoohan and the prisoner puzzle, Bush off, Obama on, and worldwide states of emergency, blowback, drafts, gas, torture, killer cops, tons more. It's monumental. It's January 16th, 2009, episode 107 of MediaMonarchy.com.
I'm gonna take your money.
MIA Paper Planes Grammy nominated. Of course, associated with the fine film, as you've heard me say time and time again, Slumdog Millionaire. So that's how we're kicking off episode 107 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you live every Friday morning, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. Friday mornings at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, also blasting out on revereradionetwork.com. That's 1 p.m. Eastern at the worldwide home of free speech. Also, thanks to KBFR 93.9 FM Boulder Free Radio for reblasting Media Monarchy. And of course, you can make contact at the usual stops: FaceBase, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, Skype, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org. I'm almost a little wistful. It's the end of an era. We're getting out of the frying pan, my friends. Before we get into Bush off, Obama on, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about Patrick McGoohan, the brain behind the masterful, legendary television series The Prisoner. Has passed away at the age of 80. We want to look at something like The Prisoner as a look at possible futures, right up there with things like 1984 or Brave New World or 2001 or what have you. The icon of individuality who will live forever as The Prisoner. This from Paul Joseph Watson, as well as numerous links to everything from Wikipedia and Rotten Tomatoes and the LA Times and the Star Central and Wired and on and on. Fans of the cult 1960s TV show The Prisoner are mourning the death of Patrick McGoohan, who passed away at age 80 after a short illness. But the role embodied by McGoohan as number six will live on as an icon of individuality and freedom in an increasingly totalitarian and controlling society. McGoohan's character, who introduced every episode with the cry, "I am not a number, I am a free man," railed against the overlords of a beautiful yet oppressive open-air prison known simply as The Village during the 17-episode series, as his ceaseless efforts to escape were continually thwarted by the authorities that ruled over the mostly brainwashed and subservient population. The series was littered with disturbing parallels to what has unfolded in terms of the Big Brother panopticon that surrounds us more than 40 years after The Prisoner was first broadcast. McGoohan himself was the creative force behind many of the episodes, as well as playing the lead role, and he made it clear in interviews that The Village and its symbolism was merely an allegory for the psychological prison of modern society. Authoritarian control, mindless consumerism, and lack of independent thought, or as McGoohan put it, quote, "the one rebel that they can't break."
It's that place that is trying to destroy the individual by every means possible, trying to break his spirit so that he accepts that he's number six and will live there happily as number six forever after. And this is the one rebel that they can't break.
To what end was that process of breaking down the individual will?
To what end?
Mm-hmm. For The Village. What was the purpose, the goal?
Fight this going on every day all around us. I had to sign in to get into this joint.
Mm-hmm.
Downstairs,
too.
Yeah.
Made you angry, too?
Slightly, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Pass keys, you know, and let's go down to the basement and all this. That's prisoner shit, as far as I'm concerned. And that makes me mad. And that makes me rebel. And that's what the prisoner was doing, was rebelling against that type of thing.
But can you, in everyday life, can you summon the will and the energy to rebel every time that petty
can't.
Indignity occurs?
You can't, otherwise you go crazy. You have to live with it. That's what makes us prisoners. You can't rebel, otherwise you have to go and live on your own, or you have to go and live on your own on a desert island.
And how
it's
much...
simple as that.
How much psychic attrition is there, spiritual attrition?
I don't understand
in
that.
Not rebelling. How much do you give away, lose? How high is the cost of not rebelling every time? Of
ulcers.
Not complaining every time?
Ulcers.
You have ulcers?
I have a couple.
Bad ones.
Not too bad. They're getting worse as we go.
Minute by minute. Yeah. What's your response to what is could really only be adequately described as a cult which has grown up around that series, the kind of mystique about it here and in Europe?
Yes, I'm very gratified because when it came out originally in England, there were a lot of haters of it. It was a love-hate relationship, whichever way you looked at it. Already there was a small cult, now there's a much bigger one over there. In fact, when the last episode came out in England, it had one of the largest viewing audiences, they tell me, ever over there, because everyone wanted to know who number one was, you see, because they thought it would be James Bond type number one. When they did finally see it, there was a near riot, and I was going to be lynched, and I had to go into hiding in the mountains for 2 weeks till things calmed down. Absolutely true.
They were angry.
Oh, yeah, walking around the streets was dangerous.
Why?
Me.
Why were they angry?
Because they thought they'd been cheated. Because it wasn't, you know, a James Bond number one guy.
It was themselves.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that later, I think.
The mystery of the prisoner. That was just a short clip from a cool old interview that's up on YouTube. I believe it's in four parts. Patrick McGoohan and the Prisoner Puzzle. And as I said, there's more from as well The Guardian and the BBC. And The Register has Farewell Number 6, The Independent, these all, of course, out of the UK where The Prisoner was originally made, Death of a Star, who will forever be more than Number 6, and finally, an oldie but a goodie from Paul Joseph Watson, We Want Information, and that's about the database state, tying in just one of the amazing things out of many that The Prisoner has brought us. So if you haven't seen The Prisoner, do yourself a favor and check it out. 17 episodes, like I said, a dystopic vision up there with 1984 and Brave New World. So we note the passing of Patrick McGoohan. Now it's time to get down to the dirty business of episode 107 of MediaMonarchy.com. Like I said, it's January 16th, 2009, and I stutter for words. It's the last episode of Media Monarchy under the Bush regime. Assuming, of course, everything goes fine. Bush gave two final appearances, if you will. There was the press conference with the lapdog White House press corps back on Monday. And last night, we had his final press conference. So we're going to hit, or rather, his televised speech from the Oval Office. We've got two. So first, this from Monday night, January 12th, Bush's final press conference, where he notes that after all the things in all the 8 years, and he addresses and answers questions from the press corps for the final time, he notes that things didn't go according to plan.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd also like to ask you about your critics.
Sure. You know any?
Well, a couple of years ago, Charles Krauthammer, columnist and Harvard trained psychiatrist, coined a term, Bush derangement syndrome, to talk about your critics who disagreed with you most passionately. Not just your policies, but seemed to take an animosity toward you. I'm just wondering, as you look back, why you think you engendered such passionate criticism, animosity, and do you have any message specifically to those, to that particular part of the spectrum of your critics?
Most people I see, you know, when I'm moving around the country, for example, they're not angry. And they're not hostile people. And they, say, well, you never meet people who disagree. This is not true. I've met a lot of people who don't agree with the decisions I make. But they have been civil in their discourse. And so I view those who get angry and yell and say bad things and You know, all that kind of stuff. There's just a very few people in the country. I don't know why they get angry. I don't know why they get hostile. There have been disappointments. Abu Ghraib obviously was a huge disappointment during the presidency. Not having weapons of mass destruction was a significant disappointment. I don't know if you want to call those mistakes or not, but they were, things didn't go according to plan, let's put it that way. And, anyway, I think historians will look back and they'll be able to have a better look at mistakes after some time has passed. Along Jake's question, there is no such thing as short-term history. Because all these debates will matter not if there's another attack on the homeland. The question won't be, you know, were you critical of this plan or not? The question is, why didn't you do something? You remember what it was like right after September the 11th around here? In press conferences and opinion pieces and in stories that sometimes were news stories and sometimes opinion pieces. People were saying, how come they didn't see it? How come they didn't connect the dots? You remember what the environment was like in Washington? I do. When people were hauled up in front of Congress, and members of Congress were asking questions about how come you didn't know this, that, or the other, and then we start putting, you know, policy in place, legal policy in place, to connect the dots, and all of a sudden people were saying, how come you're connecting the dots? And, so Mike, you know, I've heard all that. My view is that most people around the world, they respect America. And some of them doesn't like me. I understand that. Some of the writers and the, you know, opiners and all that. That's fine. That's part of the deal. But I'm more concerned about the country and how people view the United States of America. They view us as strong, compassionate people who care deeply about the universality of freedom.
I've heard all that. Farewell to Bush, the president and the man. That's from Washington Times. And Bush's last press conference, full of disappointment. That's from Time Magazine. And we could spend all day going through that whole speech. But we won't. The Guardian notes, though, as we wrap up this final press conference from Bush. 9/11, two wars, and Katrina. We had fun. It was eight turbulent years, 9/11, two wars, Hurricane Katrina, and the worst recession since the 1930s. But President George Bush's verdict at his final press conference was, quote, we had fun. He and his team had many joyous days in office, he said, quote, and people, they say, I just don't believe it to be the case. Well, it is the case. In the darkest moments of Iraq and every day when I was reading the reports about soldiers losing their lives, no question there was a lot of emotion, but there were times where we could be lighthearted and support each other. And lastly, my man Alex out in Germany notes the great pull quote from W. There's no such thing as short-term history. The other grand farewell happened last night. Bush bids America farewell in final televised speech as president. It sounds amazing just saying the words. I listened to it while I was in the shower and shaving. And he, of course, I've always said, I always wish there were times where our politicians and our misleaders and all those folks could just put down the script and just talk. They can't speak off the cuff and make it sound a little more natural, a little more conversational. So Bush's farewell speech was a lame clip show equivalent. But of course, it was also a best of. Went over all the high points. 9/11, the badge he got, be afraid, Bush's farewell.
Fellow citizens, for 8 years it has been my honor to serve as your president. The first decade of this new century has been a period of consequence, a time set apart. Tonight, with a thankful heart,
I have asked for a final opportunity to share some thoughts on the journey that we have traveled together and the future of our nation. 5 days from now, the world will witness the vitality of American democracy. In a tradition dating back to our founding, the presidency will pass to a successor chosen by you, the American people. Standing on the steps of the Capitol will be a man whose history reflects the enduring promise of our land. This is a moment of hope and pride for our whole nation. And I join all Americans in offering best wishes to President-elect Obama, his wife Michelle, and their two beautiful girls. Tonight I'm filled with gratitude to Vice President Cheney and members of my administration, to Laura, who brought joy to this house and love to my life, to our wonderful daughters, Barbara and Jenna, to my parents, whose examples have provided strength for a lifetime. And above all, I thank the American people for the trust you have given me. I thank you for the prayers that have lifted my spirits. And I thank you for the countless acts of courage, generosity, and grace that I have witnessed these past 8 years. This evening, my thoughts return to the first night I address you from this house, September the 11th, 2001. That morning, terror took nearly 3,000 lives in the worst attack on America since Pearl Harbor. I remember standing in the rubble of the World Trade Center 3 days later, surrounded by rescuers who had been working around the clock. I remember talking to brave souls who charged through smoke-filled corridors at the Pentagon, and to husbands and wives whose loved ones became heroes aboard Flight 93. I remember Arlene Howard, who gave me her fallen son's police shield as a reminder of all that was lost, and I still carry his badge. As the years passed, most Americans were able to return to life much as it had been before 9/11. But I never did. Every morning, I received a briefing on the threats to our nation. I vowed to do everything in my power to keep us safe. We have faced danger and trial, and there's more ahead. But with the courage of our people and confidence in our ideals, this great nation will never tire, never falter, and never fail. It has been the privilege of a lifetime to serve as your president. There have been good days and tough days. But every day I have been inspired by the greatness of our country and uplifted by the goodness of our people. I have been blessed to represent this nation we love, and I will always be honored to carry a title that means more to me than any other, citizen of the United States of America. And so, my fellow Americans, for the final time, good night. May God bless this house and our next president. And may God bless you and our wonderful country. Thank you.
Bush bids America farewell in his final televised speech as president from the AFP. The French agency press, U.S. President George W. Bush on Thursday hailed Barack Obama's January 20th inauguration as a moment for national hope and pride, but warned Americans against any let-up in the war of terrorism. Oh, I'm sorry, war on terrorism. In his farewell speech, after 8 divisive years in office, the vastly unpopular Bush urged agreement on his successes in thwarting attacks like those of September 11th, 2001. That doesn't make any sense. He didn't. He likes to claim that he's prevented anything else, like phony liquid terror bomb plots and provocateur street people being paid on video to talk about blowing things up, and that's what he's thwarted. But on his success in thwarting attacks like those of September 11th, I suppose I'll grant you that. On the need for global U.S. citizenship and on the historic nature of swearing in the first black U.S. president. There's another link in there to Sky News as well as USA Today and CBS News. Bush off. Obama on. Out of the frying pan into the fire, not because of the men not because of these puppets, these fronts, both paid and bought by globalists and multinational corporations and shadowy elite organizations. It's where the agenda is going. One party's in favor. They beat us down for 8 years. Throw those bums out. You vote in the other guys, they're going to beat you up for 4 or 8 years. No, let's throw those bums out. The phony left-right paradigm, they support each other. They lean up against each other. And we keep playing along. I've got two massive headings of all the disturbing Obama updates. The first one, drills, pledges, comics, and consequences. First, an update on a story we covered in December. The Bush-Obama regimes to run transitional terror drill. They did. This last Tuesday, January 13th. And Reuters notes, and I've said it before too, and it's nice again to see them just put it right out there. Red team, blue team? Bush-Obama officials hold security drill. Again, from Reuters, officials from the Bush and Obama administrations crossed paths at the White House Tuesday to participate in a homeland security exercise. The scary, hypothetical scenario was how the federal government should respond to a terrorist attack using improvised explosive devices on the transportation infrastructure and other economic targets in major U.S. cities. They also looked at responses to other disasters like pandemic flu and hurricanes during briefings, including time spent in the White House basement Situation Room, where national security crises are handled or mishandled. And again, to those who say, I don't see why you pay attention to all those war games and drills. The current Israeli slaughter was prepped by Operation Cast Lead. The Georgia-Russia-U.S. proxy war from 888 were prefaced by terror drills and war games. 9/11, there were war games and terror drills of hijacked jets crashing into buildings. On 7/7, there were drills of bombs going off in the same tube stations and the same buses, exact same time and place. The drills. And, of course, here in Portland, we're no stranger to homeland security drills, and the more they drill in a place makes me more suspicious. But I digress. Obama to send more troops to Afghanistan. Oh, big surprise there, but a nice update from the Washington Post, or as some put it, the CIA's favorite newspaper. President-elect Barack Obama intends to sign off on Pentagon plans to send up to 30,000 more U.S. troops to Afghanistan, but the incoming administration does not anticipate that the Iraq-like surge, or the Afghani surge, if you like, of forces will significantly change the direction of a conflict that has steadily deteriorated over the past 7 years. Instead, Obama's national security team expects that the new deployments, which will nearly double the current U.S. force of 32,000 alongside an equal number of non-U.S. NATO troops, will help buy enough time for the new administration to reappraise the entire Afghanistan war effort and develop a comprehensive new strategy for what Obama has called the, quote, Central Front on terror. I'm sure Zbigniew Brzezinski and the puppet masters are crafting quite the plan to use countries like Pakistan or Syria or Iran or Turkey or Jordan or Egypt to encircle Russia and China. That's the Brzezinski Trilateral Commission way. Webster Tarpley notes repeatedly that the Bush-Cheney regime is out and have been out for quite some time. It's the Brzezinski boys. It's the Kissinger trilateral again. Gangsters, you know, they come and go from the open craps table of the new financial world order. So whether it's, oh, it's the neocons, or the Trotskyites, or the crazies, or the Brzezinskis, and the Samuel Huntingtons, they're keeping on Robert Gates. Robert Gates, at the Pentagon, goes back with Brzezinski and Samuel Huntington to the late 70s, to the creation, to the fomenting of violence, the radicalization, the funding, and all those guys are back. We're going to hit, hopefully, if we have time, but at the rate I'm going, probably not, that, you know, folks at least like Kucinich or Ron Paul are guys that, for the most part, they reject the overall war on terror. But sorry, you know, you guys fucked it up. You guys blew it. You wouldn't get behind somebody like Kucinich, who's actually more where you want to be. And you're in mental gymnastics mode of trying to make excuses for, well, we just needed to get a Democrat in and now it's Obama fever. But you could have had a better candidate. You could have had an actual anti-war candidate. You could have had a guy who, or gal, or anybody who rejected the overall war of terror. Not what front is the central front on terror. Oh, I think it's Afghanistan. I think it's Iraq. I think it's Iran. Oh, Hillary won't rule out military force on Iran. This from Deutsche Press Agency. U.S. Secretary of State designate Hillary Clinton on Tuesday would not rule out the possibility of military force by the Obama administration to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons capabilities. Quote, we're not taking any options off the table at all. End quote. Does that sound familiar? That's what all your favorite phony-ass progressive Democrats say. Off the table. Impeachment was never fucking on the table for Pelosi. This, of course, was said by Shillery to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee during her coronation hearings to become the top U.S. diplomat. There's a video from Raw Story of Congress officially certifying Obama as president-elect. I think we'll hit some of those questions that linger in a moment. But another one from Paul Joseph Watson, truthnews.us. Obama's new energy czar, a socialist agent for world government. I know that sounds crazy, but we've got the info to back it up. Dig it. Barack Obama's climate czar, Carol Browner, has been exposed as being a member of Socialist International. That would be socialistinternational.org. A highly influential group headed by a Bilderberg Group luminary that calls for the implementation of global government. Despite Socialist International's attempts to seemingly memory hole information, that would be hide, information about Browner on their website, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that Obama and his cabinet are preparing to exploit fear-mongering about global warming or climate change to push new measures of taxation, regulation, and internationalism. Obama himself has, of course, vigorously promoted the revival of a bill that would slash carbon emissions by 80%, a move that would inflict a new Great Depression, cost millions of jobs, and sink America to near third world status. Obama has also publicly stated his intention to create a new infrastructure of green brigades. Google that. Green brigades and informants to regulate every aspect of our behavior in the name of saving the planet under the guise of a, say it with me, civilian national security force. Of course, the cadre we are guaranteed will be as strong or stronger than the U.S. military. Moving to the Washington Post, Obama picks CIA veteran John Brennan as his counter-terror advisor. Barack Obama's picked John Brennan as his top advisor on counterterrorism, a role that will give the CIA veteran a powerful voice on the government's use of security contractors and on other sensitive issues in which he recently has played a private sector role. The revolving door private military-industrial complex firms, and government appointments. Interchangeable. Inaugurate this, waiting for Obama, is an article up on globalresearch.ca. However, here's a nice bit from the media and the monarchy. They go together. The title really works sometimes. From the New York Times, as well as links to Wikinews and the Chicago Tribune, Spidey goes to Washington. Among the millions expected to converge on the nation's capital for Inauguration Day on January 20th will be at least one superhero. Marvel Entertainment is publishing a comic book in which Spider-Man meets Obama and foils a scheme by the Chameleon to ruin the inauguration. The six-page story, written by Zeb Wells and illustrated by Todd Nyok and Frank D'Armata, finds the wall crawler in Washington, where he uncovers a plot to undermine the incoming president. Mr. Obama has previously stated that he is a comic book fan, and a Spider-Man fan in particular. The story is in Amazing Spider-Man number 583 and hit stores this last Wednesday. Another comic book company embracing the president is Oregon-based Dark Horse Comics, which will be sending him 30 collected editions of comics featuring Conan the Barbarian. Mike Richardson, Dark Horse's publisher, said he hoped the comics would provide, quote, just a bit of escape in those brief moments away from the office. The delivery is something of a family affair, get this. It's being orchestrated between Ari Emanuel, a Hollywood agent who represents Dark Horse's film properties, and his brother, Rahm Emanuel, the president-elect's chief of staff. Rahm Emanuel, former Israeli defense soldier, co-author of a book called The Plan, about compulsory national service. You can call it a draft. Join the Green Brigade, join the Civilian National Security Force, because as I've said, and as we'll make a note of here in a second, when this fake economy crashes, maybe the only jobs will be in the Civilian National Security Force. So the last note is an O'Connor crash note on this last bit in the first posting, Drills, Pledges, Comics, and Consequences, from the Associated Press. Obama warns of dire consequences without stimulus. President-elect Barack Obama warned of dire and long-lasting consequences if Congress doesn't pump unprecedented dollars into the national economy, making an urgent pitch Thursday for his mammoth spending proposal in his first speech since the election, where he said,
"Given the magnitude of the challenges we face, none of this will come easy. Recovery won't happen overnight, and it's likely that things will get worse before they get better."
In short, a bad situation could become dramatically worse if Washington doesn't go far enough to address the spending crisis, the Democrats said, as fresh economic reports showed an outlook growing increasingly grim. The second, the more recent, the more disturbing, perhaps, Obamasiah, inaugural emergencies and the end of the beginning. First, from the New York Times, as well as Time Magazine and MSNBC, state of emergency has been declared for the inauguration.
While we're on the subject of Washington, here's indication of just how thick the security is going to be next week in the nation's capital. President Bush today declared a state of emergency for the District of Columbia, in effect this coming Saturday through Inauguration Day on Tuesday. This is largely a formality. It allows the federal government to provide the extra funding for the extra security, but it is an indication of the massive preparations underway in a city that fully expects to be all but locked down for that swearing in.
Oh, but it's just a formality, though. I grabbed that video from MSNBC and posted it up to youtube.com/mediamonarchy. State of emergency declared for inauguration. It is true, President Bush sounded alarms about Obama during the campaign season. On Tuesday, Mr. Bush went one step further. He declared Mr. Obama's inauguration an actual emergency. The declaration, though, was not a political statement about Republicans being run out of town. Rather, it was a bureaucratic move intended to provide additional federal money to help Washington cope with the huge crowds that are expected to turn out for the ceremony next Tuesday that will make Mr. Obama the nation's first black president. The government has set aside $15 million to help pay for security and medical personnel, but Mayor Adrian Fenty asked for more money, citing possible crowds of 1.5 to 2 million people and, quote, the associated stresses that it would place on the city's capabilities, particularly the medical community, said Scott Stanzel, spokesman for Mr. Bush. Mr. Bush granted the request as a precaution. Mr. Stanzel said, if Washington needs the money, it can apply for reimbursement through the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The declaration will also allow federal public health workers to join in the public safety effort. The president's power to declare a state of emergency is typically used after natural disasters. Although Mr. Stanzel said presidents had occasionally declared emergencies before an anticipated event, but never before, he said, has an advance declaration been used for a non-disaster. So never before has the president issued a state of emergency in advance of a non-natural disaster event, such as an incoming hurricane. It's interesting to note, of course, that Jeb Bush on September 7th, for some strange reason, put up a state of emergency in Florida. Right before his brother George came down on September 10th. But I digress. Several more notes for the inauguration, which I'll readily admit, as I'm sure most of you won't quite so readily admit, that I'm kind of nervous about it. I'm not nervous that some stupid redneck will try something. I'm worried some type of crowd mass kind of psyop event. The telescreens are going up around the country, around the world. Everyone will be staring at the jumbotrons. There'll be, I'm sure, lots of fantastic psyops and imagery and neuro-linguistic programming. But we've noted that Obama is making the bed for NASA and the Pentagon to get in it together. RogueGovernment.com notes that NASA is going to show off one of their new lunar modules at the inauguration. NASA is sending a prototype of its new lunar rover to appear in the presidential inauguration parade in D.C. The six-wheeled small pressurized rover, or SPR, will provide the big geeky finish to the line of floats and marching bands scheduled to head down Pennsylvania Avenue on January 20th. The hope is that the new Obama administration will support NASA's current plan to return to the moon on or around 2020. The battery-powered lunar SUV will be piloted by astronaut and SPR project manager Mike Gernhardt. When it reaches President Barack Obama's box at the end of the parade route, space-suited astronaut Rex, that means King, Walheim will detach from the vehicle carrying the American flag. He will take several steps towards the reviewing stand, stop, and salute the new president, ending the parade. NASA to show off their new lunar module in a nice little space event at the parade. We sidebar note that another Intel expert says that Obama is likely to face a nuclear crisis in the first year. But more on the pre-inauguration tension. Arrest Bush 2009 plans Inauguration Day protest. This from Raw Story. A group calling itself Arrest Bush 2009 has announced on arrestbush2009.com its intention to hold a Yes We Can Arrest Bush event in front of the FBI building in D.C. during the inaugural parade. However, coordinator Jose Rodriguez insists, quote, it's not a protest, it's a celebratory event. Arrest Bush 2009, which is sponsored by the Washington Peace Center after Downing Street and Shoes for Bush, shoebush.org, is demanding that Bush be arrested for war crimes and for lying to the American people. Another sidebar note from newswithviews.com, Chief Justice John Roberts meets Obama in private. And this is when I should note that tuning around on the AM dial a few days ago, I think it's 8:50 here in Oregon, a right wing, which is to say Bush-loving, flag-suckling, 9/11-believing jackasses in the false left-right paradigm. I hit, I think, 8:50 a.m. the other night, and they're talking about Philip J. Berg of ObamaCrimes.com and his dogged pursuit in the Obama citizenship question. Many others have been shot down in trying to get something into the Supreme Court. Phil Berg has made it the furthest. They've knocked down some of his, he's come back with more, and now they're going into some kind of special session sometime in the week or so after the inauguration to talk about his charge that Obama is not a natural-born citizen. We're not seeing the full vault copy of the birth certificate. And that perhaps this is a travesty. Phil Berg always notes, of course, that he's a Democrat, and he wants just the truth to be out there. I've covered the Obama citizenship case from time to time on here. However, I finally, it's maybe kind of formulated a little more in my head, that maybe the Obama citizenship question is the controlled demolition of Obama truth, if you will. You've maybe heard me say, as a 9/11 researcher, skeptic, truther, whatever, I've lamented for many years now that the main focus became the buildings and controlled demolition. And that's what everybody pays attention to. That's what all the documentaries are about. That's what all the news clips will cover. Because it's a little more flashy. It's attention-getting. But as I've said, I think all that shit's gone, and we're not going to know, and it's meant to bog us down. And as long as we ask the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about what the answers are going to be. So, I think that the Obama citizenship case, important as it is, however, it's actually massively important. I'm not trying to downplay it. However, I think there are far more effective ways and things and facts to get at. And I believe what we would see if it came out that Obama was born in Kenya or lost his citizenship when he went to Indonesia, if it came out that that was actually true, the Obamazoids would be twittered to mob-like groupthink action. Flash mobs, phony people-powered coups, the likes of which Brzezinski and his ilk are excellent at fomenting in Eastern European countries, color revolutions, people-powered coups. If it came out that Obama wasn't actually a citizen, his willing and duped masses would be twittered into action, and we would bend over backwards to change the Constitution that weekend, and it's hello, Arnold, or anyone else like him. Like him being, of course, the son of a Nazi. As we noted, of course, too, I forgot to say this as we were listening to Bush on one of his last few words there, on his last speech. He said that we've never tire, never falter, never fail. That's Nazi speak. That's straight out of Hitler speeches. And if you'll recall, Mr. Arnold Schwarzenegger at the 2004 RNC, up on that stage where, you know, in his head, and he said, and he's quoted, always dreamed about being a dictator or savior like Jesus or something. Speaking of Bush, he said, he is a leader who doesn't falter and doesn't fail. So that was a long digression. However, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court John Roberts is meeting with Obama in private. Are they going to talk about Filburg's case and what the fuck they're going to do about it? I don't know. Moving on. New York Daily News. Feds cite racist chatter as the reason for a higher state of alert at the inauguration. Federal agents are on a, quote, higher state of alert. And you can hit also the counterterrorismblog.org. As well as more from the New York Daily News. Federal agents are on a higher state of alert because of hate talk by white supremacists about Obama's inauguration, officials told the Daily News on Tuesday. That chatter's out there, no doubt about it, one senior FBI agent in Washington said this afternoon, adding that no credible plots against the 57th, or rather 56th, presidential inauguration have been detected. The Bureau has ordered all agents in all 56 field offices to, quote, shake the trees in advance of the January 20th swearing-in of the 44th president, who will become the first African-American to occupy the Oval Office. Quote, they're talking to sources to determine if there's any threat information in regard to the inauguration, the FBI source said. Everybody in law enforcement dealing with that particular white supremacist clientele is on a higher state of alert, a senior agent at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives told the New York Daily News. The ATF has experience infiltrating white supremacist groups. I bet they do. A classified threat assessment for the inauguration by the FBI and the Homeland Stupidity Department citing agitated hate groups was sent to police agencies this week. Counterterrorism officials have also picked up chatter from Islamic militants, but the agitated domestic hate groups are the big concern, said another FBI official. But Secret Service Director Mark Sullivan told reporters at a briefing with local officials, quote, we have no credible intelligence to suggest a credible threat. During Obama's campaign, white racists in Colorado and Tennessee were charged in separate plots against the candidate. Local officials from D.C., Maryland, and Virginia cited security concerns Tuesday for new restrictions on those attending the ceremonies, a throng estimated, as we said, between 1.5 and possibly 3 million. The historic ceremonies will be the largest national special security event ever. At least 20,000 cops, federal agents, and National Guard troops will be deployed. And as a gruesome side note to that, from ThreatLevelOnWire.com, online threat to kill Obama leads to arrest. However, we're going to move to TechRadar.com. Obama's high-tech inauguration day. D.C. will be the focus of the world's media Tuesday for Obama's inauguration, and that means it will also be home to some cutting-edge technology. The Department of the Interior is responsible for all streets but one entering the downtown mall area where the parade and ceremony will occur. It plans to oversee the event using a wall-sized display of flat-screen LCD monitors called the OptiPortal, made by the Electronic Visualization Laboratory, EVL, evil, at the University of Chicago. The OptiPortal takes ultra-high resolution images backed by supercomputer power to provide expansive, razor-sharp, eagle's-eye aerial pictures of the inauguration site, and I'm sure it's also doing some biometric face scanning and profiling. Another one on the citizenship tip, this again from Threat Level, Molotov Mitchell strikes again, Obama's not an American, about viral videos about Obama's citizenship. Again, what I think is perhaps the wrong avenue to pursue. All you gotta do is look at all his Council on Foreign Relations, neocon, Goldman Sachs, Brzezinski, trilateral backing. And all the things they're already doing. Like appointing New York Federal Reserve Chairman as the Treasury Secretary. However, it might get a little ugly. I'm sure, however, that a nice Federal Reserve boy will still have no problem being appointed. However, Timothy Geithner faces tough questions on taxes, and a housekeeper Again, from the Deutsche Press, Agentur, President-elect Barack Obama's pick for Treasury Secretary could face tough questions in his confirmation hearing after problems arose Tuesday with his taxes and the immigration status of his former housekeeper. Having an illegal housekeeper seems to be fairly common among our political misleaders. However, the one we don't generally talk about is the fact that most of them don't pay their taxes because they know it's a bunch of bullshit. Big government is back as Obama pledges that the U.S. will give a lead to the world. That's from timesonline.co.uk. However, from newsmax.com, Obama's intel advisor involved in security breach. Remember John O'Brien? We just mentioned him a few minutes ago. Obama's top terrorism and intelligence advisor, John O'Brien, heads a firm that was cited last March for breaching sensitive files in the State Department's passport office. This according to a State Department Inspector General's report released this last July. So John Brennan and his company involved in security breaches at the State Department's passport office. That's our new top terrorism and intel advisor. As if you didn't know, Obama's support among Republicans grows. Although Raw Story notes that it's behind the scenes. But as we've noted on here, neocons like Max Boot or fake Christians like Pat Robertson say, "I'm just pleased as punch with the way things are going with Obama's administration. He's put more hawks and nut jobs and CFR, APAC, Israel First crazies in there than we could have ever gotten away with." Obama's neocon dinner. Here's a nice one. This from McClatchy. This could ruin their reputation. Ha ha. From progressive.org, Matthew Rothschild, who does good work. That's the link for you. However, the original's from McClatchy. Sorry. Obama's neocon dinner. This could ruin their reputation. President-elect Barack Obama Tuesday evening attended a dinner party at the home of conservative columnist George Will, attended by fellow conservatives William Crystal and David Brooks. The press pool following the president-elect reported that he left his temporary home at Washington's Hay Adams Hotel Tuesday evening and arrived a short time later at Will's home in Maryland suburbs. A press pool photographer shot a photo of Crystal. That's William Crystal, son of Irving Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard, one of the signers of the PNAC document. And of course, also there was David Brooks, also a columnist at The Old Gray Lady, the New York Times. But no other scribes were noted, and there's links in there to the Washington Times, as well as the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which we have bad news about coming up a little later. David Brooks, just about a year ago, wrote an article, and it's linked up for you, talking about the seemingly amazing fascist uprising of Obama and his masses. He wasn't exactly saying it was bad, but he was saying the Obamazoids were kind of like junkies. They were all junked out on hopamine. Webster Tarpley notes it in the book Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. Farmers wary of Obama administration. That's from theusdaily.com. However, big surprise, more Council on Foreign Relations minions being appointed to prominent positions within Obama's coming criminal cabinet. Obama picks Council on Foreign Relations President Richard N. Haass, H-A-A-S-S, to be his top foreign policy advisor and envoy. U.S. President-elect Obama has chosen President of the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, Richard Haass, along with senior CFR member Richard Holbrooke and CFR member Dennis Ross as special foreign envoys and foreign policy advisors reporting directly to Obama, that reported by CBS News. Richard Holbrooke has also been a CFR director three times, as he is presently. Richard Haass is also a CFR director. Even the CBS News, reported by CFR member, anchor, propagandist Katie Couric, with a link to my video of Katie Couric interviewing CFR Prez Richard Haass on YouTube.com/MediaMonarchy. Even the CBS Evening News, with CFR Couric, they identified Haass as the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Not surprisingly, CBS did not bother to mention that both Richard Holbrook and Dennis Ross are also members of the CFR. However, as I've noted before, it seems like never before did neocon nuts, reactionaries, fascists, Trotskyites, globalists, call them what you want, they never seem to get more coverage than they do from The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. So here is a quick bit of Council on Foreign Relations President Richard N. Haass on The Colbert Report.
My guest tonight thinks the next administration faces great challenges abroad, but nothing compared to challenges it'll face from me. Please welcome Richard Haass. President of the Council on Foreign Relations, all right? You guys toy with countries of the world like toys, don't you? You're like the Illuminati, you're the Masons, you control everything, don't you? That's the rap on you guys.
What's so interesting now, though, is about who's on the chessboard. The toys, if you will, are a lot more than states. It's all sorts of non-state actors, it's good guys, it's also bad guys.
Well, like you're like the Illuminati, you're the Masons, you control everything, don't you? That's the rap on you guys.
What's so interesting now, though, is about who's on the chessboard. The toys, if you will, are a lot more than states. It's all sorts of non-state actors. It's good guys. It's all bad.
Haass, president of the CFR. There he is on the Colbert Report with, of course, Colbert throwing out, as he likes to pronounce it, the Illuminati. Haass, you heard in a somewhat poorly captured clip. But the whole one is there. It's linked up for you. You hear him mention the chessboard, which, of course, the grand chessboard, Brzezinski's 1997 book that lays it all out. Much like a Project for a New American Century document, it basically says, in order to assert and reassert and maintain Western hegemony, we're going to have to do A, B, and C. But those things are really difficult. Unless you have a new Pearl Harbor or a catalyzing event or external enemy. So yeah, never before would we see guys like this on talk shows joking and cheering along, and they run shadowy organizations that, again, as we note now, it's very appropriate. Bill Clinton's inaugural address in 93, where he mentioned his mentor, Carol Quigley, who was the historian for the Council on Foreign Relations, and I don't have the quotes right in front of me, of course, but he noted, he only has one problem with the Council on Foreign Relations and their stated goals of tearing down national sovereignty and establishing a global governance. His only disagreement is that they wanted to keep it secret. So if you don't know who these guys are, if you don't know what these organizations are, if you don't know how pervasive they are, if you don't know how interlocking all these things are, you're just being led around. So when you watch these shows, it's like, oh, there's some Disney Jonas Brother bullshit. Oh, it's CFR president. Oh, it's ha ha ha. It's in your face. Because they can't hide it now. Because tons of jerks like me are trying to ask uncomfortable questions. So, more of the same from the change administration. This from The Guardian. Senate approves $350 billion in bailout funds requested by Obama. A divided U.S. Senate has approved President-elect Obama's request for $350 billion in unspent financial bailout funds. I believe this is the TARP, troubled asset, yada yada. The 52-42 vote releases the money in the midst of rising foreclosures and a worsening climate for U.S. banks. It marked Obama's first legislative victory days before he assumes office. The vote came amid strong opposition from critics of how the first $350 billion has been spent. Obama said he wants to use the money to unclog the credit markets and extend loans to consumers, small businesses, and municipalities. Obama's transition team said he would also use $50 billion to $100 billion of the money to reduce the number of house foreclosures. Last couple bits. There's a video. Yes, we can make real change. That was sent to me by my man Jamie, and it's funny, you think it's going to be about working for the Obama administration as this guy's sort of putting together boxes and press kits and stickers and things, and you finally realize that it's anti-Obama. Yes, we can make real change. Finally, though, from Infowars.com, Starbucks, are you in Obama's civilian national security force? Starbucks wants to make it easy to join Obama's proposed paramilitary brown shirt volunteers. Quote, Starbucks will honor each person who pledges with a free tall brewed coffee beginning Wednesday, January 21st through Sunday, January 25th. The goal of the effort is to raise pledges in excess of 1 million hours of service from all over the country. A Starbucks press release states, with a link for you, Starbucks wants to, quote, make it easy to participate in the president-elect's call for national service. Back in September, the Christian Science Monitor reported that Obama plans to, quote, leverage volunteerism in communities across the country and make government cool again. Fortunately, a lot of people are beginning to realize government is never cool. As the founders warned a couple of hundred years ago, in the months ahead, these folks will likely clash with Obamatron zombies, maybe even in the streets. I don't like that last note there, but it's interesting to see your favorite mainstream service outlets, the last few products available, Starbucks. They're trying to pledge you for national service. I believe that's the last note on this coming coronation of Obama. I should also tell you now that we're well into hour number two of episode 107 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 16th, 2009. I'm sure I've probably slipped up at some point and said 2008 still. It's January 16th, 2009, 4 days before the coronation, before we all line up in the square for the telescreen to see the swearing in. It's the end of the beginning. It's the last episode of Media Monarchy under the Bush 2 regime. But don't worry, they have more Bushes up their sleeves. Check out George P. Bush. He's a cute one. He's half Hispanic. And he's coming soon. Like I said, it's episode 107 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 16th, 2009. My name's James M. Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and the show that comes to you from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and revereradionetwork.com. Live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time and 1 p.m. Eastern. 2 hours of the best news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Also blasting out on KBFR 93.9 FM in Boulder. Boulder Free Radio out in Colorado. And of course, hit me up, FaceSpace, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, Skype, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org, all with Media Monarchy as your keyword. We keep coming back, I keep coming back, to the guy that I wish we were swearing in come this Tuesday, because he's a guy that has a lot more experience in a lot more ways. He also knows, if you know, and of course, if you ask people right now, what's the biggest issue facing us right now, everybody would say it's the economy now. Dr. Ron Paul knows a thing or two about the economy. He and others like him, as I've said time and time again, people like Peter Schiff or Bob Chapman or Nouriel Roubini or Taleb or Max Kaiser, they all know what's up. They all know it's fake money. It's the Federal Reserve. It's private banks. It's central banks. It's money out of thin air. It's derivatives. It's credit default swaps. It's phony money. It's really what the money changers were in the Bible. It's literally that. I was really happy to hear a few friends at work have been checking out The Money Masters, the best documentary on the creation of money and the history of money that you'll ever find. The Money Masters. You must check it out. So Ron Paul knows what's up. However, with this clip, we're not exactly going to be talking about the economy. We're going to be talking about how he, and of course, the other few brave progressive folks on both sides of the aisle of the phony left-right paradigm, people like Ron Paul and Maxine Waters and Dennis Kucinich, and even, big-time surprise to me, Nick Rahal out of West Virginia, a state rep from West Virginia. Nick Rahal, Maxine Waters, Ron Paul, and Dennis Kucinich were the only folks to vote against a House resolution which recognizes Israel's right to defend itself against rocket attacks fired by Gaza.
Madam Speaker, I rise in opposition to this resolution, not because I am taking sides and picking who the bad guys are and who the good guys are, but I'm looking at this more from the angle of being a United States citizen and American, and I think resolutions like this really do us great harm. In many ways, what's happening in the Middle East, and in particular with Gaza right now, we have some moral responsibility for both sides. In a way, because we provide help and funding for both Arab nations and Israel. And so we definitely have a moral responsibility, and especially now today, the weapons being used to kill so many Palestinians are American weapons, and American funds essentially are being used for this. But there's a political liability, which I think is something that we fail to look at, because too often there's so much blowback from our intervention in areas that we shouldn't be involved in. You know, Hamas, if you look at the history, you'll find out that Hamas was encouraged and really started by Israel, because they wanted Hamas to counteract Yasser Arafat. And you say, well, yeah, that was better then and served its purpose, but we didn't want Hamas to do this. So then we as Americans say, well, we have such a good system, we're going to impose this on the world. We're going to invade Iraq and teach people how to be Democrats. We want free elections. So we encourage the Palestinians to have a free election. They do, and they elect Hamas. So we first indirectly and directly through Israel establish Hamas. Then we have an election. Then Hamas becomes dominant, so we have to kill them. You know, it just doesn't make sense. During the 80s, you know, we were allied with Osama bin Laden. And we were contending with the Soviets. It was at that time our CIA thought it was good if we radicalized the Muslim world. So we financed the madrasa schools to radicalize the Muslims in order to compete with the Soviets. There's too much blowback. There's a lot of reasons why we should oppose this resolution. It is not in the interest of the United States. It's not in the interest of Israel either.
I could not have said it better myself. And there it is, from the guy who should have been president, Dr. Ron Paul. Interventionism. We fund all the sides. We play both ends against the middle for whatever our needs may be during that decade. If you just take a couple minutes and look at the history of the funding and of the radicalization, and whether it's Operation Ajax, overthrowing Iran, overthrowing Mossadegh in 1953, one of the first CIA adventures, but certainly not the last. It's what we do. And while it may seem in a way as for the last 8 years, it's, of course, it's been empire building. It's been interventionism. It's been crazy neocon Western empire building. But they kind of fuck it up. They're kind of dumb. How could they have done 9/11? They can't even get Katrina right. But Ron Paul hits it out of the park every time. There's links in there, and I'm not sure if that was the full clip or not. The full video's there, and of course, the transcript on the House.gov page, and you can read and see who voted against the resolution which recognizes the wife beater's right to defend himself. Staying international now, it's geopolitics, gas emergencies, pirates, nukes, and the North American Union. First, from Voice of America, VOA News, as well as other links to the Times Online. States of emergency. Europe freezes as Russia cuts off gas. With freezing temperatures across most of Europe, there was heated anger, especially in Eastern Europe on Wednesday, about the suspension in natural gas deliveries from Russia through the Ukraine. The gas crisis comes at a difficult time for leading politicians, especially in Bulgaria, where some 2,000 people demanded the government's resignation on Wednesday over allegations of corruption. The shortages of natural gas from Russia added to anger of protesters who braved the cold in Bulgaria's capital, Sofia, to demand the resignation of the country's socialist-led government.
No wonder they're calling it a new Cold War. Across the continent, temperatures are plunging, so demand for gas is soaring, just as Russia has all but turned off the tap. Hot air from Brussels won't change things, but the EU threatening to get tough if the gas isn't back by Thursday.
We are demanding them to get back to the negotiation table immediately in order to reach a permanent settlement that will stop the situation once and for all.
The problem is Europe depends on Russia for a quarter of its gas supplies, and Moscow's row with Ukraine has cut the major transit route, hitting supplies from Turkey in the east right across the continent to affect even France and Germany. The dip in supply in the West, dwarfed by the crisis in countries entirely dependent on Russian gas. Just look at the effect on Bulgaria, where almost a third of the population have been left without heating as temperatures sink to minus 16 degrees. They've switched some systems to run on electricity, but suppliers are warning the surge in demand could lead to power cuts. And deliveries of gas to industry have all but stopped, costing Bulgarian business £245 million a day. The Gazprom row, a timely reminder of how fragile our energy supplies are when faced with unwanted political pressures. Rachel Younger, Sky News.
Moving on in the geopolitics, it's on to the pirates and... what is it? Sheldon Frauda, Shameful Joy? Maybe this isn't exactly that. It's probably just kind of funny irony. Tanker-grabbing pirates drown. This from Danger Room. The 1,000-foot-long Saudi oil tanker Sirius Star, which we noted numerous times on the show, and its tie-in with the dog canine meme that was weaving through the last couple months, of course, that we covered with Clyde Lewis of the Ground Zero Lounge. The 1,000-foot-long Saudi oil tanker Sirius Star has been released after a ransom was paid, 2 months after Somali pirates launched a shocking raid to capture the $150 million vessel and its $100 million cargo of crude oil. But in a bizarre twist, five of the newly wealthy hijackers drowned while celebrating their windfall. Skipping down later, as the pirates were motoring back to shore in boats, quote, singing in colorful tone and exchanging some ridiculous words, one boat capsized and five pirates who could not swim drowned. More from the Associated Press, more from the Somali press about the Somali pirates, and one kind of funny note. Lethal technology making its way from the U.S. to Iran via front companies. That's from the Washington Post. and it's worth diving into, but we got to keep moving. ThinkProgress.org. Cheney says it doesn't matter that we haven't captured bin Laden. After the 9/11 attacks, President Bush famously declared that he would capture Osama bin Laden, quote, dead or alive. However, less than a year later, in March 2002, Bush said that he was, quote, not that concerned about the al-CIA leader. On CNN's late edition, Wolf Blitzer asked President Cheney, how frustrating is this to you personally, knowing he's still at large? Cheney hesitated, then simply replied that he would obviously like to solve that problem. He added that it's more important to keep this country safe, indicating that bin Laden is inconsequential. As, of course, is the mention of anything to do with 9/11 missing from bin Laden's most wanted poster on FBI.gov. Because they have, quote, no credible evidence. Or rather, no, sorry, no hard evidence. Rex Tomb, FBI, bin Laden, no credible evidence, 9/11. China's authorities are running scared. That's an article from The Guardian, and it sort of typifies what's going on around the world as we've looked at Greece and as we've looked at Iceland, and now as we look at Russia and Bulgaria. In a way, it seems as though the hammer is falling on the people. However, in a very real way, it also seems as though the elites have almost overplayed their hand. They meant to break things down. They meant to destroy U.S. status. They meant to break us down. They meant to implement new financial, new world order systems, global governance. They're kind of fucking it up. And it may be beyond their control. That, of course, I suppose would be one of the better case scenarios that we could look at. China's authorities are running scared. An interesting one by way of Cryptogon.com and The Telegraph, Operation Blackjack, a story of nuke attacks on major Western cities. This little curiosity comes to us from The Telegraph's Culture Picture Galleries. As of now, there's an entry called Operation Blackjack, the story of a terrorist nuclear attacks on major Western cities. It's a slideshow of photos, and on the page at one point you read, Blackjack, a slideshow story. The events portrayed in this slideshow are entirely fictitious. There is, of course, no author listed for this, but it basically lays out an interesting scenario. So anytime there's foreshadowing and, of course, drills or tabletop exercises or white paper think tank reports, we like to look at the things they say and the imagery they use and nukes going off and Ferris wheels and the symbology and the semiology and the memes buried within the pictures and the words. However, the last note on this geopolitics posting, gas emergencies, pirates, nukes, and the North American Union, Mexican collapse and the plan. This from Kurt Nemo, again at truthnews.us. A writer named Mike Sunix, writing for the Phoenix Business Journal, phoenix.bizjournals.com, with a link for you, of course. Mike Sunix, writing for the Phoenix Business Journal, exposes details of a recent report released by the Pentagon, with a link for you to jfcom.mil. According to the report, globalization and urbanization will fuel, quote, social unrest, as well as a potential collapse of the Mexican government as that country deals with violence and corruption induced by drug cartels and organized crime. On the surface, the Joint Operating Environment 2008 report, linked up 2.8 meg PDF for you to download from the military, from the Pentagon, Joint Operating Environment 2008, and it's, of course, by Joint Forces Command, and it's, of course, a self-serving document, and it, of course, predicts multiple crises. If there are major reductions in U.S. defense spending, including terrorist networks obtaining nuclear and biological weapons, as well as instability and aggressiveness involving China, India, Pakistan, and the Middle East. On the other hand, the report may be seen as a blueprint for the establishment of a North American Union or a North American community or whatever Robert Pastor or the CFR are pushing. So there are multiple links and multiple reports about an imminent possible collapse of the state and the government and the country of Mexico. Dallas Morning News, Fox News, of course, the military themselves, U.S. News and World Report, and on, Mexican collapse and the plan for a North American Union. That also reminds me at some point in Bush's farewell speech last night that he mentioned prosperity and security and prosperity. And those are the two words of the SP, of the SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership between Mexico, the United States, and Canada. Another agreement meant to break down any type of sovereignty, any type of state control. It's what ties in with the NAFTA superhighway or the Trans-Texas Corridor or whatever new toll roads are coming. A little bit about the war. As, of course, they want to try and keep off the front page. I was listening, I think, to some Chris Rock stand-up last night from Never Scared 2005 album. And he talks about a lot of the stuff just being something to distract you from the war, to take your mind off of the war. From USA Today, who I have to admit, the more I've done the site, will actually, from time to time, have good reports that aren't available in other places. More combat equals more suicides, plus a reinstated draft. First, the more combat, more suicides. Army suicides rise as time spent in combat increases. Josh Barber, former combat soldier, parked outside the Army hospital one morning last August, armed for war. And he went to Fort Lewis to kill himself to prove a point, his wife says, Kelly Barber. Here I am, I was a soldier, you guys didn't help me. Now that's the truncated version, of course, as many of these stories do. They start out with the human interest angle. So Josh Barber went to Fort Lewis, killed himself out front. Skipping down, Barber's suicide is part of a larger story. The record number of soldiers, Marines, and combat veterans who have killed themselves in recent years at a time when the Pentagon has stretched deployments for combat troops to meet President Bush's security plans in Iraq. The Marine Corps reported 41 actual or suspected suicides in 2008, a 20,000 increase over 33, or rather 20% increase over 33 in 2007. In 2007, the Army counted 115 suicides, the most since tracking began in 1980. By October 08, that record had been surpassed with 117 soldiers. Final numbers for 08 have not yet been released. So the last part of this equation, more combat equals more suicides plus a reinstated draft. Tony Blankley, author Tony Blankley, joined Fox's Gretchen Carlson and Steve Doocy to talk about his new book, American Grit, where he says that we should, you know, reinstate the draft so we can invade Pakistan.
Welcome back, everyone. 7 minutes before the top of the hour. Can America's power last forever? And how do we achieve a new nationalism that puts our country's survival first?
Those questions and more are addressed in a brand new book by Tony Blankley. It comes out today. It's called American Grit. What will it take for America to survive and win in the 21st century? And joining us for his first TV interview about the book is Tony Blankley. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
If you read some of the European papers, they're talking about America is finally in decline. They're getting what they've had coming to them all along. Do you believe that?
Well, it could be so. We have it in our power not to be in decline, and that's what my book's about. I do believe that for the first time in our history, if we don't do a lot of things smart and tough, we could get overwhelmed by the rise of China, the rise of India, the rise of radical Islam. We failed to exploit our energy, we're not paying enough attention to what our kids are learning. Bill Ayers is actually a senior person in guiding curriculum design of America. That started just this last March. So we have it in our power. And I try to write some tough proposals for what we need to do so that our grandchildren live in a country strong enough to protect our freedoms just as we do.
Yeah, Tony, your book's going to get a lot of attention because there are some controversial, bold suggestions. The first one, obviously, that caught my eye was that you're calling for a universal draft, which would mean that all 18-year-olds in America would have to serve for 2 years.
Yes, look, I don't like it. I love the volunteer army. I've got a son who's a second lieutenant in the volunteer army. I know the young men and women who serve. They're the greatest young kids we've ever produced. But we don't have enough troops, and it's manifest that we don't by several magnitudes. For instance, when George Bush wanted to have the surge, he was told by the senior generals we didn't have the extra 20,000 troops to finish the war. Now, he decided to go against their advice, but the advice of the top generals says we didn't have the 20,000. Now Obama wants to go to Afghanistan, maybe a good thing, but he says we don't have the troops unless we pull them out of Afghanistan, out of Iraq. What happens if Pakistan goes jihadi? We can't go in there and stop them from taking over the nuclear weapons. And I'll tell you the worst example of the shortcoming. If we had had enough troops in Iraq, we wouldn't have lost 4,000 great young men and women. It only took 80,000, like Rumsfeld said, to win the battle against the Republican Guard. But then we needed to flood the field, as we did in Germany after World War II, with 300,000 troops occupying every village and every building, and they would never have been able to rise up. So the fact that we didn't have enough troops have cost us 4,000 deaths and countless thousands more seriously wounded. And we have grave dangers ahead of us. We have to be armed.
Well, it is a great read, and there's a lot of stuff to chew on and think about. Check out the new book. It's called American Grit. What will it take to survive and win in the 21st century? Tony Blankley? Tony, thank you very much. Congratulations on a great book.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Congratulations on your book talking about a new draft. But of course, we're going to need it. And they're talking about occupying forces sweeping the land. And it's very real. And again, as we note, as we're watching the phony left-right paradigm, the agenda still moves forward. There is a note about the draft from thehill.com. Representative Charles Rangel, Democrat from New York, likely will introduce his controversial legislation to reinstate the draft again this year, but he'll wait until, of course, after the economic stimulus package is passed. Asked if he plans to introduce the legislation again in 2009, Rangel last week said, quote, probably. Yes, I don't want to do anything this early to distract from the issue of economic stimulus. Rangel's military draft bill did create a distraction for White House, or for rather, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, soon after Democrats won control of Congress after the 2006 election. Remember the one where it was going to stop the war and impeach and all that shit? Bullshit. Complete bullshit from your fake, phony Democrats. Rangel calls a little stink back in 2006 and 7. There are links to H.R. 393, Universal Service Act of 2007. In the wake of that historic Democrat victory, Pelosi said publicly that she did not support the draft and that the Democratic leadership would not back Rangel's legislation. She also said Rangel's legislation was not about reinstating the draft, but was instead, quote, a way to make a point about social inequality. That may be. I'm sure that point is missed either willfully or ignorantly by many folks. So we had Tony Blankley talking about his book, American Grit, saying reinstate the draft because, you know, Obama's going to need it when we send everybody into Pakistan and more into Afghanistan as we expand the phony war of terror. Again, this guy, they all quibble about the small points. I think we should put more soldiers here. I think we should put more soldiers there. I think we should fund this more. I think we should have more green brigades and brown shirts and snitches and civilian national security forces. They all agree on the larger idea of the GWAT, the Global War of Terror. And I'm sure anyone probably out there listening would say you would rather have a candidate who would say, no, I don't believe in any of this shit, in the war, in all of it. Spend that money on love and food. I find it's appropriate now. As I see, I won't be able to go over all the stuff I have set out on the table for you on this episode 107 of MediaMonarchy.com, January 16th, 2009. But perhaps the most appropriate way at this end of an era, end of an error, and the beginning of new errors to come, we should go over the latest 9/11 updates. DNA, documents, WTC7, and TV. First, from Kurt Nemo, truthnews.us, government claims it has DNA of alleged 9/11 hijackers. Forensic investigators have recovered the charred remains of most of the 9/11 hijackers to honor a pledge that they would never be buried with the victims. That is a report from Daily Express, express.co.uk. Flesh or bone from 13 of the 19 Al-Qaeda terrorists who flew passenger jets into the Twin Towers in New York and the Pentagon in Washington have now been identified. Again, quotes from the Daily Express. If we are to believe this report, the FBI spent millions and employed, quote, the brilliant skills of forensic scientists, unquote, to ID the remains of the alleged terrorists. I say alleged because there is plenty of evidence. Many of the supposed hijackers are, of course, maybe still alive or were alive at the time. Link, link, link to all the guys whose names I won't run through. All those, quote-unquote, terrorists variously reported to be alive, with the exception of Amir Bukhari, who died in a small plane crash before 9/11. Moreover, there's no solid evidence the alleged hijackers were on the fatal flights. The one thing I'll just mention on that note is that, of course, you know, the photo you always see of Muhammad Atta boarding the plane. That was his first flight. That's his connecting flight. There's no photo of him getting on the plane that was hijacked. It's a trick. That's him in Portland, Maine, boarding his first flight. Moreover, there's no solid evidence the alleged hijackers were on the fatal flights. For years, 9/11 researchers not only claimed that the names of the putative terrorists did not appear on the flight manifest, but no Arab names appeared on the list. In fact, as NowPublic.com notes, quote, the U.S. government withheld the actual passenger lists for years, and the lists are not the passenger manifests, but lists of victims. By not releasing these documents, the U.S. government actually encouraged speculation that the hijackers' names did not show up on the passengers' list. In the most intense crime scene investigation in history, scientists sifted through a mountain of concrete dust, buckled iron, and shattered glass to find what was left of the terrorist. Stuart Winter, again, writes for what we're quoting from originally the Daily Express. And yet, more than 1,000 people who died on 9/11 have yet to be identified. Do you know that? No trace has ever been identified of 1,151 of the 2,749 people who died at the Trade Center, USA Today reported on April 20th, 2006. Those were the numbers in 2006. In February 2005, the medical examiner's office announced that attempts to identify remains had exhausted current DNA matching technology. Apparently, the FBI now has some sort of super-duper DNA technology reserved for identifying terrorists. So, government claims it has the DNA of alleged 9/11 hijackers. From CNN, as well as from the horse's mouth, from archives.gov/research/9/11 commission, 9/11 Commission documents released. The National Archives on Wednesday released records from the 9/11 Commission, the bipartisan panel established by Congress in 2002 to assess the circumstances leading up to the 9/11 attacks. According to the archives, more than 150 cubic feet of records have been released that include information on terrorists, past terrorist events, Al-Qaeda, and other related subjects. The records are scheduled to be available on the archives website Wednesday, and they were. And they are, and I downloaded the PDFs. I have not had time to look into any of them. I'm sure other enterprising readers and researchers will find interesting things to come in the 9/11 omission report. Again, I should note, when we hit any of these 9/11 updates, there are some times in my head where it sounds as though I've heard this before, I'm repeating it, or maybe you feel that way as well. I've heard that. The updates are constant. There's constant news and constant puzzle piece fitting going on in the crumbling cover-up of 9/11. Again, as we close out the Bush era, the 9/11 era, as we get out of the frying pan. So as we look at all these latest 9/11 updates, it's all still there. It's all still bubbling, blurbling, pouring out. Newly uncovered WTC7 video betrays more foreknowledge. Again, we hit last week where we had FDNY guy Restuccio talking about in the afternoon about Building 7 of, we may have to take it down. Another video from 9/11 has been uncovered, which proves the collapse of WTC7 was anticipated beforehand, despite the fact that the event was unprecedented. No steel frame building completely collapsed from fire damage alone in previous history. And again, look at the video of Building 7 going down. Experts who were just shown the videos of it, hey, check this out. They look at it and go, that's a beautiful controlled demolition. And then they find out it was Building 7. A widely publicized aspect of the collapse of Building 7 is the fact that news organizations received foreknowledge that it was coming down well in advance of its eventual collapse. Both the BBC, and if we jump back to February of 2007 on MediaMonarchy.com, when we discovered that the BBC, on the afternoon of 9/11, announced Building 7's collapse 20 minutes early, not coming on saying, we've heard there's maybe some trouble, they're coming on saying, Building 7, the Solomon Brothers building, has collapsed, it's fallen down, while Jane Stanley stands there with the building behind her, and then her feed cuts moments before time-stamped and synced up, the building was about to collapse. The other one from CNN, the same month, was rediscovered. Aaron Brown is of course, the different note. Aaron Brown on CNN. Aaron Brown is from New York. Jane Stanley was the UK reporter in New York. She was just given the feed back to the BBC and to the studio. Aaron Brown was on, I believe, the top of the CNN building, looking out, and he gets the report and gives the report that Building 7 has collapsed, and he turns around, or is collapsing, because Aaron Brown's from New York. He knows that Building 7 was a 47-story tall building. It would be the tallest building in most cities in the country. He looks over his shoulder and goes, it's fucking right there. It hasn't collapsed. And he stutters and hems and haws, or is collapsing. But I digress. Another one. In the following clip, Fox News correspondent David Lee Miller states that, quote, well, let's just let him state it for himself.
We have correspondent David Lee Miller on the scene. David?
Hi, Linda. That's right. At this hour, the fire still continues to burn. You can take a look behind me. You can see a great deal of black smoke, a huge plume of black smoke that you can see throughout all of Lower Manhattan. We are told by one firefighter source that a building identified as Trade Center Number 7 is in danger of collapse. We are told that engineers have gotten as close as they can to the building, and that this building is on fire, and that there is a chance that this building could give way. And we are told that if it does, they expect that it would collapse in a southerly direction. The World Trade Center towers fell northerly. This would fall in the opposite direction. Right now, they are doing their best to try and contain the situation. Emergency vehicles are on the scene. The streets to Lower Manhattan are effectively sealed off to all pedestrian traffic. The only thing allowed down here are a few media vehicles and, of course, firefighters, police, and EMS. Now, Mayor Giuliani held a news conference a short time ago. He said that as many as 200 people have been critically hurt. In total, right now, 600 taken to area hospitals. The big question, though, at this hour, how many people are actually entombed, are trapped in the rubble.
Now, of course, that may seem to fly in the face of what I was ranting about earlier, about how, lamentably, the controlled demolition aspects are the things that everybody focuses on the 9/11 story. However, in that realm of somewhat speculative, however, also peer-reviewed, researched, And of course, NIST has to keep coming back saying, oh, how about this? Building 7 is, of course, the Achilles heel of any of the building events, if we want to focus on those, which I don't really. But there's so much video evidence that still keeps pouring out. And again, new videos, new clips, new analysis, new perspectives on things. Again, as you learn one thing, it sheds light on many other things. But as I said, I think, and I like this analogy. Once it hit me, I was like, yeah, I like that. That the Obama citizenship question is the controlled demolition of Obama truth, if you will. There are tons and tons and tons of provable, disturbing connections, money trails and funding and puppet strings behind things like 9/11 and Barack Obama. Pertinent questions that need to be asked. However, if they can get you to ask the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about what the answers are. Perhaps the controlled demolition question and the Obama citizenship question are the wrong questions. And again, as we note, Supreme Court is actually going to do something with Philip Berg's lawsuit after the inauguration. We also note that John Roberts is having a secret meeting with Obama, perhaps discussing this issue. And I'll say it one more time. I heard it on 850 AM talk radio here in Oregon, a Bush-loving, flag-suckling, bullshit, phony, right, conservative station, bringing up the Obama citizenship question. It shocked the hell out of me to hear it, that it was coming out. Again, AM radio, who listens to that? Well, millions and millions of people. If it would actually come out that Obama's not an actual citizen, the people-powered, twittered masses will hit the streets instantly and will bend over backwards to change the Constitution like it was nothing, thereby opening the door to folks like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I'm sure far more sinister. He's a big cartoon Nazi bastard. It's hard to miss his garbage. But I digress. And I want to hit on this last bit of 9/11 updates, DNA documents, WTC7, and television. We've mentioned many times before Daniel Sunjata, S-U-N-J-A-T-A, the star of Dennis Leary's FX hit television show Rescue Me, where he plays a firefighter in post-9/11 New York. Daniel Sunjata, the actor, is an ardent 9/11 truth supporter. There's awesome pictures of him wearing 9/11 truth t-shirts on red carpet runways. He's given passionate speeches for one of the other great presidential candidates that didn't get the time of day, Cynthia McKinney. Again, a friend of 9/11 truth and an actual progressive Democrat. And she was black, so you could have voted for her and got that good little whitey guilt off your shoulder, too. Rescue Me character believes 9/11 was an inside job, and so does the actor playing him. This from a KansasCity.com blog called The TV Barn, and it's a story that is an update a little bit. It did leak out in recent weeks that Dennis Leary's show Rescue Me was going to feature some 9/11 truth-related upcoming plot lines in this new season. And they did, and it does. The writer here asked more questions about it, where they say, boy, did I open a can of worms at the press conference for Rescue Me, the great Dennis Leary comedy. I wasn't aware that it was actually a comedy. I'm sure there are comedic elements in it, but it's probably a drama, I'm sure. It's back for a fifth season, and in watching the second episode, I noticed the show drifting back to the 9/11 memories theme it explored at length in the first season. So I grabbed a microphone and pursued that questioning with the producers, and I asked a couple of the actors to chime in as well. One person I asked was Daniel Sunjata, who plays Franco on Rescue Me. I asked him because there's this fascinating "Where did this come from?" scene in the second episode of the fifth season. A French journalist is interviewing firemen who were at Ground Zero on 9/11 for a new 10th anniversary commemorative coffee table book. And then Sunjata's character launches into this.
You're going to hear from me. You're not going to hear from anybody else because my opinions, well, let's just say they're not popular. 9/11? Inside Job, plain and simple. All you gotta do is connect the dots, and I'm not talking about the dots everyone's already heard about. I'm not talking about Bush sitting in that school reading a book about a goat to those kids for 7.5 minutes after he was told to nose. Everybody knows that. I am talking about a massive neoconservative government effort. It's been in the works for over 20 years. You ever hear of PNAC? Project for New American Century?
Perhaps.
Yeah, well, according to them, the end goal of their effort is American global domination. Full spectrum dominance, they call it. Now, the first question that pops to my mind is, how do you pull that off in this day and age? Well, according to them, you do it in four steps. First, we must control the world's oil, especially the oil in Central Asia and the Middle East. Now, I don't have to remind you that Bush-Cheney, they came to power with plans already made to attack Afghanistan and Iraq. Number two, we have to make huge technological advances with our armed forces that for some reason include the capability to fight wars from outer space. Number three, surprise, surprise, huge increases in military spending pay for the above, $130 billion a year worth. Now, never mind the sick and dying first responders, 9/11's heroes, who can't even pay their light bill, let alone their medical bills, and a lot of them end up homeless because of it. I guess there's just not enough room in the budget for them. Number four, and this is key, we change the definition of preemptive attack, so we can unilaterally bomb the shit out of, invade, and occupy countries even if they pose no credible threat or had nothing to do with 9/11. One problem. How are you going to put it into action? I mean, the American people are never going to go for no shit like that, right? You're damn straight. Now, what you need is an event. An event that gets everyone's heads turned around the right way. What you need is a new Pearl Harbor. That's what they said they needed. And you're looking at a guy who went to 58 funerals in 26 days, I can tell you that is sure as shit what they got. Are you single?
A funny little kicker tag there. Are you single? Franco. Daniel Sunjata's character says there on that clip from the second episode of the fifth season of Rescue Me, where he basically lays out the scenario of a 9/11 inside job. My only complaint is, of course, that it's always pinned on the neocons. Oh, it was the Bush guys. It was just them. If we've talked about anything on this episode, the end of the beginning, Bush off, Obama on, it's going to be meet the new boss, same as the old boss. We're going to have to make it happen. And the Obama sigh, of course, says that himself. It's not about me. It's about you. But it's also about you not believing the hype of this Goldman Sachs, Brzezinski clique that has now come in with all their intelligence folks all still there. Robert Gates staying on. Kissinger close at hand. CFR, Dennis Ross, Richard N. Haass, Clinton at the Secretary of State. Federal Reserve, Goldman Sachs connected banksters coming in. And again, what folks and economists like Jim Rogers and Peter Schiff or Ron Paul or any of them note, that their answer to all this is, of course, more of the same. So what we're going to have to do as we shift, as we see the end of an era, break down the phony left-right paradigm and realize that regardless of Bush or Obama, they're both bought and paid for by the globalists, by multinational corporations and shadowy elite organizations who don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. You have to make, we have to make, I have to make my own community better. That's what we're going to have to focus on. You know, getting more positive words from the female perspective from my girlfriend. She's kind of been on point, I think, that if we see this collapse of economy as it furthers, as it will, and as I would say, barring the complete Mad Max Dust Bowl scenario, it's going to cause us to work in our own community more. We'll have to, whether it's paying money for some local band or your neighbor playing guitar on the street corner. We're going to have to spend our money and grow vegetables together and create our own currencies and figure something out if this is the way things are going to go. Because the big boys, they don't give a fuck about you. As Carlin notes repeatedly, it's one big club and you ain't in it. And then, of course, it's the American dream. They call it the American dream because you got to be asleep to believe it. We're going to close this episode 107 of MediaMonarchy.com, the last episode, hopefully, under the reign of King George II. We're going to look at some of the creepy customers checking out the site, MediaMonarchy.com, in the past week. I look at them. I watch them from StatCounter.com. We had the Southern Systems South Australia government read about, of course, Barry Jennings and the mysterious death of the 9/11 Building 7 eyewitness. The Kroger company out of Cincinnati, Ohio, they were reading about Portland cops. That would be our Portland, Oregon cops testing, you know, license plate cameras that store and track data. We had the WPP Group advertising and marketing out of New York City. Always interesting to see the sort of PR and marketing firms and the kind of behind-the-scenes image makers of what, of course, Edward Bernays called propaganda. The Metropolitan Government of Nashville, they Googled remote viewing Mengele. Mutual of Morning Sun out of Iowa, they Googled corrupt Sheriff John Cheney, Winfield, Iowa. The Holy Family College out of Philly Googled media monarchy. Ubisoft Entertainment out of Montreal, I believe they're a video game maker. They were reading about 9/11 preview, jumping back a couple years on MediaMonarchy.com. Of course, that 1979 Airlines ad that I think was from Pakistan that shows a plane of basically flying into the Trade Center towers. Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions out of Baltimore, Maryland. They Googled flying syringes. Of course, that's incorporating mosquitoes to give you vaccines. That's a great idea. Lockheed Martin out of Denver, West Virginia Network for Educational Telecomputing, I guess out of a college or something. They Googled 9/11 one timeline. We had the U.S. House of Reps out of Manassas reading about the powerful solar storm that could shut down the U.S. for months. We had the Drug Enforcement Administration a couple times. The Mercy Hospital out of Texas. They Googled JFK Jr. airplane, and I was basically the third result, which is amazing. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, that's NASA, they Googled Columbia accident black box, which if they don't know and have to look it up, we're screwed. Pavlov Media, Distributed Management Information Systems, DMISI, out of Barrow, Arkansas, or rather, Alaska. Pennsylvania Video Games Military Recruitment, we of course hit that on the B-side yesterday. 20th Century Fox out of California, we're reading about Good Bobby, the new play by Brian Lee Franklin about RFK. Echelon Telecom out of Portland, Oregon. Someone there Googled Presidio Media Blogspot. The California Department of Water Resources. We're reading about the Econo crash, threats, Cheney, Seattle, UBS, and Kucinich, which we didn't have time to get to on this episode, where Kucinich, again, the candidate you could have gotten behind, the candidate that we could be swearing in on Tuesday, who is maybe really actually anti-war and more progressive, but no. Kucinich, of course, notes that the Federal Reserve is as federal as Federal Express, which, of course, he had to have gotten from watching documentaries and books and things like The Creature from Jekyll Island or The Money Masters or America, Freedom to Fascism. Wyden and Kennedy out of Portland, Oregon, was on MediaMonarchy.com, as well as the National Institutes of Health. They Googled Masonic Inaugural Ball, which we went over last week, of course, during the inauguration this Tuesday, the first ever Freemasonic Inaugural Ball. An Army Barracks out of Norfolk, Virginia, Googled Freemasons in Gitmo, And DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, of course, the Mad Science Agency out of Silver Spring, Maryland, they were reading about their posting about how the DARPA chief is going to stay on for now, and of course, how they're putting together a Mad Scientists convention. Those and other things I also couldn't get to on this episode. Police State International, Miltech, Mad Science, Danger Training, and Tasers. We'll hit that on the B-side in a few days. And finally, InBev, the multinational corporation that recently bought Anheuser-Busch, and only now do the bottles and cases say, the great American beer. The moment it's not American, they put on the label, it's an American beer. No, it's now Belgium beer. Someone at InBev in Antwerp, Belgium, Googled JFK TV series, and that's, of course, Tom Hanks teaming up with Vincent Bugliosi to debunk the JFK assassination conspiracy. Lots of luck. And we're all going to need lots of luck, and I hope and pray that everything will go okay as we end this Bush era, Bush off, Obama on. Thanks for listening, my friends. Last episode under King George II, we hope. And like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.